So, I guess I could write that title down, but it's sort of a fun number of buzzwords that I just kind of throw in because describing exactly what I'm going to talk about in a title is either sort of too short and misleading or too long and doesn't matter. But I figure I'm in a mathematical physics sort of seminar, so I might as well start with some motivation from physics and specifically some motivation via theory X. So when I talk about a quantum field theory, I'm going to take the functorial point of view, so that a d-dimensional quantum field theory for me is going to be some kind of functorial assignment. I'm going to be a little bit loose at the start of the talk as well. From some kind of Bordism category to some kind of linear category. So, for instance, if I look at closed manifolds of various dimension, I'm going to want to send a closed D manifold to a complex number. Going to want to send a closed D minus one manifold to a complex vector space. And I'm going to want to send closed D minus two manifold to a C-linear category. Higher codimension corresponds to higher sort of category number. Ooh. Gonna have to be careful. Try that. Okay, so let's start with a very simple, sort of a stupidly simple example of a quantum field theory is going to be the trivial d-dimensional quantum field theory. So what does this do? It sends a closed D manifold to the number one, sends a closed D minus one manifold to the complex vector space C, and it sends a closed D minus two manifold to say the category of complex vector spaces. It sounds, like I say, it's kind of like a silly example, but it's actually going to be quite important. So sometimes you're studying some quantum field theory, a d-dimensional quantum field theory. So maybe you write down a Lagrangian and you do some calculations and you find, oh dear, this quantum field theory doesn't actually make sense. It's not well defined. Or at least it's not well defined independently. So what you find is that you can extend it, you can find a bulk theory in d plus one dimensions that you can sort of couple it to, and it lives as a boundary theory for this bulk theory one dimension higher. It doesn't make sense independently. F does not make sense independently of alpha in this case. I can formalize this. So this was done, introduced in a paper of Dan Fried and Konstantin Telemann in the notion of a relative field theory. So let alpha be a d plus one dimensional quantum field theory. Then a quantum field theory relative to alpha is going to be a homomorphism. Well, either from the truncation of the trivial d plus one dimensional theory. So when I write this, I just mean forget what your theory did on d plus one manifolds, don't evaluate it there. To the truncation to d dimensions of alpha, or alternately, go the other way from the truncation of alpha to the truncation of the trivial theory. To make that sort of match with this picture here, rather than just thinking of this as living on the boundary of this bulk theory, you can think that it's actually sort of an interface between the trivial d plus one dimensional theory and alpha. So for instance, let's look at this one. If I evaluate on a d manifold now, rather than getting...
So what do you call truncation again?
Literally just, I don't know anything about what it does to D plus one manifolds. Forget what it does on D plus one manifolds.
Sorry, are those F and F tilde like equivalent pieces of data? Or are they adjoint functors or something?
I'm not sure. I don't actually know whether or not you can always get like an F tilde from an F.
The other thing is the free to tell them I don't give a definition of homomorphism.
Yeah, right. This is true. This is one reason to be kind of a little bit loose at the start of this talk. Right. If I evaluate F on a D manifold now, rather than getting a number, I get an element in some vector space, specifically the vector space that alpha assigns to the D manifold X. And similarly, if I apply it to a D minus one manifold, I'm going to get an object in the category that alpha assigns to Y. So let's observe that if I compose these theories in this order, this is actually going to be an absolute quantum field theory, i.e. sort of an ordinary one that I described over there. So why is that? Well, if alpha, if I compose them, I've got a map from the trivial theory to the trivial theory. So if I take a quantum field theory relative to the trivial theory, then alpha of XD just becomes the complex numbers. So I recover that I get a number assigned to a D manifold. Alpha of YD minus one becomes the category of complex vector spaces. So I recover that I get a vector space associated to a D minus one manifold. So the idea, and something that I'm going to play with, is that if you take a relative quantum field theory plus some extra data, which you can see what the extra data has to be, it's going to be sort of another one of these boundary theories, but I'm not always going to spell out the boundary theory. From that, we want to produce an absolute quantum field theory.
Right, so you have this F and F tilde, so the condition is you should be given both F and F tilde, is that?
If you give me two relative field theories, one like this and one like this, which are relative to the same bulk theory, alpha?
Well, I mean, like F and F tilde, this is different kind of data, right? You can say there's homomorphism, but in different directions, right?
Yes.
Well, there's different data, so you go both a relative QFT.
Yes.
They should be adjoint, right?
Yes? No?
Examples.
Okay. I don't actually know. So we're going to look at theory X, which is maybe otherwise known as sort of the 6D2,0 superconformal field theory, which denote XG, where G is an ADE Lie algebra. And this is actually not an absolute quantum field theory, otherwise I wouldn't have told you all of this. It is in fact a relative field theory, and it's relative to some seven-dimensional topological quantum field theory, alpha G.
I think that your definition of quantum field theory is topological quantum field theory, right?
Well, this is why I'm being very, very rough. Like, you could make it actually...
Because this X is not supposed to be topological, right?
No, but I did not say topological quantum field theory over here, and it's one of the reasons that I'm being very sort of...
But so when I say Bordian category, kind of implicitly mean that somehow it should be Bordian some additional structures. That...
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Some kind, like, you know, some kind of Bordism category, maybe with like a Riemannian structure. And like, I'm definitely not thinking just of topological theories, but to make it rigorous, I mean, you can make it rigorous for topological theories. I don't know if you can make it rigorous yet for many other things. Okay. So let's take theory X, which is a 60 relative theory. And now let's take a look at different ways that we can do, well, two things from it to obtain new theories or absolute theories.
You give a precise mathematical description of the 70 theory?
You can. I mean, it's the topological gauge theory, but I don't. It's not going to be sort of necessary for what I talk about, so. So let's look at ways that we can compactify this theory down to lower dimensional theories and then turn it into an absolute theory. So one thing that we could do is choose an element tau in the upper half plane and compactify on the elliptic curve corresponding to tau. So this fairly famously gets you Supiang-Mills with coupling constant tau, but I haven't actually chosen anything to make this an absolute theory yet. It's still relative. So it still actually only knows about the data of the Lie algebra G. So what am I going to do? Well, to turn it into an absolute theory, I'm going to choose a gauge group. This is one thing I can do, is choose a gauge group. And I'm going to do that by choosing a particular type of maximal isotropic subgroup inside of this cohomology group. Details of this don't particularly matter yet, but I do want to put it up there so that you can see that later on we're actually dealing with the same kind of data in another example.
Sorry. You didn't tell us what the 70 theory was.
I didn't.
You're also not going to tell us what the 5D bulk for that
Supiang-Mills
theory is, or are you going to?
No, I'm not.
You're telling us that.
I'm telling you it's relative to something, but what exactly it is relative to is actually not going to be. It's not going to be important for anything I tell you, sort of, for this
so
motivation.
I'll just take your word that this lattice is the right information for giving.
Yeah. Yes.
The purpose of what I explained now is that if you want to explain it somehow, you can construct a four-dimensional theory with certain properties. Is that?
I want to see that I'm going to get certain dualities.
Yes.
So, like,
In four dimensions.
In four dimensions and in two dimensions, but I'm not going to worry about six dimensions. And
so, having six and seven dimensions is only for motivational purposes, right?
Yes. So we'll compactify this further on a Riemann surface C, and we'll wind up with some two-dimensional sigma model, which you can use notation for. So I'm just going to call it sigma G. And this is a sigma model with target the moduli space of G Higgs bundles on C. So remember, this is a G bundle on C and a Higgs field, which is a section of the adjoint bundle twisted by the canonical bundle. Okay, so there is a duality that's going to come from the fact that I know that this theory came from a 60 theory compactified on a torus. So specifically, let's take a look at the element S inside of the mapping class group of the torus. So S is going to simultaneously act on the upper half plane and also on this cohomology. Let's see what it does first at this relative level. Well, this relative level, I haven't done anything with this cohomology yet. So I'm going to wind up with Supiang-Mills with coupling constant minus 1 over tau. Now, I'm going to make it absolute, but now with respect to a different choice of maximal isotropic subgroup, right? I apply S to gamma, And you can ask, what's that actually going to do? Well, this minus 1 over tau is still there. But if you follow through exactly what's happening when you apply S, you'll see that you actually wind up with the Langlands dual group here. Remember, I'm working with ADE type Lie algebras and groups. So yeah, this has the same Lie algebra as that, even if they're different forms of the group. And this is fairly famously S duality for 4D n equals 4 super Yang nils. And then again, I can go down on this Riemann surface to get something that's a 2D absolute theory. There's going to be a duality induced there, and sort of, again, famously, this is T-duality for the moduli of Higgs bundles and the moduli of Higgs bundles for the Langlands dual group. Okay. So this is one sort of fairly familiar picture. So now let's do.
So you had this choice of this maximal perfect subgroup.
Yes.
In H1, so somehow, what role does it play in solid here?
So.
For instance, you produce this.
So this.
Starting from this gamma, but then. You said there's not, you have some kind of S of gamma on the operator side. So
the vector space that sort of say the partition function of this relative theory lives in is like the Heisenberg representation, Schrodinger representation of some finite Heisenberg group. This choice of a maximal isotropic subgroup. Yes, technically I probably want a maximal isotropic subgroup and a splitting, so that I get a map from here into the Heisenberg group. Now this acts on that vector space, and I can take invariants with respect to gamma.
But my question was somehow, it's the same, I mean, you said that somehow you also have some S dual notion of gamma, right?
Right, the point is after I apply S, right, now I've got a different maximal isotropic subgroup, and I'm taking invariants with respect to a different subgroup.
So can you explain what is S of gamma? So you're saying that given any gamma, that's right.
I mean, for instance, yeah, I mean, this is, if I have the A cycle and the B cycle on the torus, you know, I could choose the A cycle, and the A cycle will give me the simply connected form of the group, I'm pretty sure. If I apply S to this, I wind up with the B cycle. If I ask what is the group that corresponds to the B cycle, it will be the adjoint form.
Like, how can you tell the difference between the A cycle and the B cycle on a torus?
Because I'm secretly keeping track of the.
Exactly.
When I said choose tau, I didn't mean just remember like the class of the elliptic curve. I meant actually remember tau.
Yeah, but they're saying, I mean, it's probably the same thing. They're saying that this gammas are in one-to-one correspondence with various groups with given Lie algebra.
No, not quite. You can find gammas which correspond to groups which have this Lie algebra, and you can also find, you can find other stuff as well that's floating around in there that doesn't just correspond to.
But is it true that for any gamma you can define because one four-dimensional theory is that the statement?
If you give me gamma, I can apply S to it, and even I could start with something over here that did not give me usual super Yang mills, and I could apply S to it, and I will get something else that does not give me usual super Yang mills.
Any gamma defines a four-dimensional theory.
Yeah, a four-dimensional absolute theory. Yes.
So where does gamma come from in physics?
I'd say something like it's a choice of
condition for this.
Yeah.
7-bit theory compatible on the torus.
Does it give us a definition of 6D?
It's take the 5D gauge theory of true forms valued in the center of the group.
Yeah.
And then you ask what are the boundary conditions for those. They're labeled by gamma, at least the most basic ones.
So let's do the same thing, but let's actually now go down first to a 4D relative theory on our Riemann surface. See? So this sort of the example of the theories of class S. So first I'm going to get some relative theory, SGC. Let's now, just straight away, let's go down to a 4D absolute theory by again choosing some subgroup in H1 of the Riemann surface with coefficients in pi 1 of gad. That's going to give me some four-dimensional absolute theory. And now let's go down again to 2D on a torus. And again, we've got some two-dimensional sigma model. So sigma model, and we can ask, what is the target of the sigma model? All right, well, what do we know about it? Well, this mapping class group action that I got from compactifying on a torus, I have that down here as well. So the S transformation is actually going to act here again. But I've drawn it as acting to itself. So why is that? Well, it's not affecting the Lie algebra G that I chose. It has nothing to do with the curve that I compactified on. And this gamma is data that has to do with the curve. I'm choosing, for instance, maybe a set of A cycles on the curve. So this really doesn't change any of the data that I used to define this theory, or at least so far as I've presented it to you. So it should be a self-duality. Of the theory.
So sorry, this the six-dimensional theory.
Yep.
There are two conformal directions. Right. And in that first thing,
yep,
those were the first directions you ate with that
yep
elliptic curve.
Yes.
Going down on the path you just described,
yes,
are those the two directions you left? Or did you eat those somewhere?
Are those the two directions? Sorry, I'm...
Yeah, the same two directions, just switched order.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. At a first approximation, all I've done is change the order of compactification. But the trick, of course, has happened here, in this step, right? I changed the order of compactification, but there was also some extra data I had to provide to give you the absolute theory in 4D. And what that's changed now is the fact that I had, you know, t-duality between two different looking theories when I went down on the elliptic curve first, and now I've got some self-duality of this theory.
The question I was asking is, where did the tau go? Where is tau hiding?
It's in a choice of point in the Teichmuller space of the surface.
Okay.
Doesn't the target
so
space of the
C is actually a Riemann surface?
Yes.
With, okay.
What's different than C and sigma G? Sigma G is your name for the theory, or
this one, this sigma G? Yeah, it's a sigma model, so I just called it sigma. I needed to write something. Yeah.
And the target space of that sigma model depends on tau, isn't it? Does it?
The target space of this
sigma G
sigma model?
Depend on the conformal structure on C.
It's a moduli of Higgs bundles of some kind, right?
Yeah, it's going to be some kind of moduli of Higgs bundles. It's not going to be like that moduli of Higgs bundles because, well, one thing we know that in general, the moduli of Higgs bundles is not self-dual, right? But it is going to be at least related to or some kind of moduli of Higgs bundles. So one thing you might mean, by the way, when I say self-dual is that maybe you mean this has a sort of self SYZ vibration.
You're repeating a lot of different expressions as well. You had this one explanation on the left, and then and there it was not self-dual. And now,
mm-hmm,
how is what you're doing now different from what you were doing there?
Because over here, the mapping class group of the torus acted on two things, right? It acted on my choice of tau, and it acted on this subgroup here. Over here, the mapping class group of the torus does not act on this, right? So it's not actually changing any of the data that I've given you that you would use to define this theory.
But on the other hand, if C is a torus, that's what is it like? or is not allowed?
If C were a torus, I mean, I think you could probably take C to be a torus, but then you've got to be a little bit careful about studying the moduli of Higgs bundles on the torus.
You have two SLTC arguments there, right?
Yes.
C can be anything.
Yeah, actually, that's a good point. The if C was the torus, then all I'd be saying is act with this S transformation that's only acting on one of the tori.
And we should stress that the twist does not treat the two surfaces symmetrically.
Yeah. Yes.
Therefore, the final sigma model does depends on the compositional Riemann surface in a very different way than it depends on the compositional of the torus.
Yes. Yeah. That's another thing that's being a little swept under the rug.
But okay. You could have done a third thing, right? You could have done left everything relative until the very end.
Yes. Yeah, I could have gone down. Yeah, this is not like an exhaustive list of options. And there was no reason that, for instance, I had to make the theory absolute at this stage. I mean, there's no theory reason necessarily that I need to make the theory absolute.
So if you didn't make the theory absolute, then there never would have been this choice of gamma.
Yeah.
Does that mean that on the left-hand board, if I go down to a 2D relative theory, then it's self-dual before I pick
the
boundary condition?
What you'll... What you'll get is that you'll see that the boundary conditions for... Boundary conditions for the bulk theory? There'll be an action, I mean... Yeah, I think the answer is that there's going to be the theory will have a bunch of self-dualities, but those self-dualities there's internal structure to the theory. So for instance, like a category of boundary conditions or different categories of boundary conditions, and your transformation, your S transformation, for instance, will move those categories between each other. So there's no... Yeah, there's no problem. There's no inconsistency. Yeah.
I'm confused. You have two different kinds of gammas, right? So.
I mean.
Yeah. On the,
they're kind of the same
yeah.
kind of gamma, right?
Are they the same?
I compactified on something, and then I chose a maximal isotropic subgroup inside of H1 of that something.
Yes.
Yeah.
But that
the something is different, but yeah. Like
so you made two different choices. I mean
yes.
two choices, right? So but on the right path, do you also choose when you compactify down from SG to sigma G, choose that gamma inside H1 of T2?
Once it's absolute.
No.
It's a
yeah.
different different.
Yeah, at this point you have an actual quantum field theory. Like an absolute quantum field theory. There's no extra choice that you're gonna make to try and get a different absolute quantum field theory in like 2D, right? The place that gamma comes in is going from relative to absolute.
Yep.
Once I'm absolute, I don't make that choice.
But, okay, when you define the boundary condition for the 7D TFT, so you don't have to make a choice of gamma inside H1 of T2 by 1 and G.
I think it's dangerous to think about them as boundary conditions for the 7D theory. There are no local boundary conditions for the 7D theory. Otherwise, there would be, you could have made, well, usually, otherwise you could have just used an absolute 6D theory. That is. But once you go to 5D or you go to 3D, then you can have boundary conditions.
Local ones.
Yes.
It's on a non-local in the
So if you've done the third thing of going all the way down to 2D and then to 2D relative and then to 2D absolute, it's only would have been a very intricate possibility of different choices of a third type of gamma, which
in H1 is like 4-manifold or like H1 plus H3 with 4-manifold.
Yeah,
yeah,
something like that. I don't actually.
Okay.
Yeah. you're making this choice of maximal isotropic inside of H1 because it gives you a choice of maximal isotropic inside of H3 of the six manifold, which is, you know, C cross whatever you're evaluating on.
If you stay in 5D, for example, by compact flying to 6D theory on the circle, then can you get that relative version of Super-Yamiot's polyvalent as a boundary theory on 5D theory?
If you just go down on a circle,
yes,
you'll get a relative version of 5D Super-Yamiot's.
And we'll be able to see the choice of gamma as a choice of boundary condition in 5D theory.
You're in 5D, so the bulk theory is one dimension.
And then whose compactification might give you somewhat of a boundary condition of the 5D theory, but not all of them. All
right, so theorem in quotation marks. There exist self-dual moduli spaces which are consistent with physical expectations. So I can construct something that I can show is self-dual, but I can't actually show that it's the thing that you get from the physics. I can't derive it from the physics yet. This, incidentally, will wind up being a corollary of a more general result. Which is sort of a generalization of the mirror symmetry for Hitchin systems results of Hassel and Thaddeus. In 2003, and Nagy and Pantev. So Hassel and Thaddeus did type A, Nagy and Pantev proved something for arbitrary reductive groups. Thus concludes the physics, or the physics-y part.
So the imagine spaces for any choice of gamma.
Yeah, there'll be a choice of gamma involved.
And so is it true that somehow, suppose that a group is E, so somehow it's not gamma, then is it the same as before? I mean,
if you're working with EA, then yeah, it's mirror symmetry for the moduli fixed models. Somehow the interesting situations are really, well, yeah, the interesting situations are when you have a choice of gamma, when you can make a choice of gamma. If you can't make a choice of gamma, it will just reduce to sort of Nagy and Pantev. Okay, so for the construction, let's fix a Riemann surface C of genus greater than or equal to 2. We'll fix a point in C. We'll take a connected, simply connected, simple group. And whenever I write sort of a tilde over something, I mean it's the simply connected form of the group. And I'm also going to choose an embedding, which I guess I also called tau. It's not at all the tau of the other board. Of the center of the group into some algebraic torus. So let's define a group G tau to just be G times T moduli the center of the group. So these are familiar groups, or at least a lot of them are. So for instance, GLNC, I can realize as SLNC times C star modulo nth roots of unity, acting as scalar matrices. I can get the odd spin C groups by doing this. If I take the symplectic group, then I can get the general symplectic group, which is, you know, matrices which preserve a symplectic form up to scale rather than on the nose. And then I don't know if this group has a name, so I'm actually writing it up so that if it has a name, somebody in the audience can tell me. Which is spin 4n times C star mod mu 2 times mu 2, which is another thing that you could construct from this procedure.
So these are all Langland self-duals?
For instance, spin C. Yeah. But GLN will be, the spin 4n example will be, but spin C and GSP will be swapped. Okay. There's some kind of determinant map, which is just the projection from G tau onto the torus mod the center of the group. And that induces a map from the moduli stack of G tau Higgs bundles on C to, well, the moduli stack of T mod Z bundles on C, but we can actually just decompose that as, T mod Z Higgs bundles on C, which we can decompose into bundles and H naught of the canonical bundle tensor with the Lie algebra of T.
Right, the fact that something embeds entities is important, that we just need a morph.
We need an embedding. And actually, I want to take S to be minimal. I don't want to take like a huge algebraic torus and then just like a cyclic group embedding into it. If I've got a cyclic group, I just want to take C star. The embedding's a little bit annoying sometimes, but it's fine. Why did I say that this is a determinant map, by the way? Well, for GLN, this is literally going to be the determinant map. So in the GLN case, the map that's induced is going to be, take the determinant of the vector bundle and the trace of the Higgs field. Map to here. Okay. Inside of bun T mod Z, let's define a lattice, which I'm secretly using X to give a trivialization of bun T mod Z. When I do this, just because to compare it to something later, this is the co-character lattice of T mod Z, or is isomorphic co-character lattice. So, let's see. So I'm going to define something that you might be the thing that I was going to study. Higgs bullet, because I'm ruled by whatever the LaTeX command is. It's going to have as its connected components lambda x, and I'm going to define it as a pullback, of Higgs G tau over sort of the trace-free locus. So I embed this lattice inside of here, and then I just focus on trace-free Higgs fields. This turns out not to be the object that I want. Why is it not the object that I want? Well, it's carrying a bunch of sort of redundant information. So for instance, if I was studying SLN Higgs bundles, then, or say vector bundle, Higgs vector bundles with a determinant some fixed line bundle of degree d, say, then the degree d part of the moduli space is going to be isomorphic to the degree d plus n part of the moduli space by tensoring with O of x. So more generally, the co-character ladder just of the torus acts on this space, moving between connected components, and I'm going to define the moduli space which we're interested in, MGC, just to be what happens when I get rid of this sort of extraneous geometric information. Finally, there's an action of H1 of the curve with coefficients in the center of the group on this space. It's just sort of tensoring with torsors for the center of the group. Now we have the ingredients to state the theorem. Note as well, everything that I've done kind of preserves the map to the Hitchin base, so there's still a map from MGC, so the Hitchin vibration, to the Hitchin base. So let's choose gamma inside of H1 of C with coefficients in the center of the group, not making any assumptions about it being isotropic or maximally isotropic now with respect to the skew pairing. Then away from the discriminant locus, some bad locus in the Hitchin base, there is an isomorphism of commutative group stacks over the Hitchin base. So let's take MGC mod gamma. Let's restrict away from this discriminant locus in the base. Say what this is in a second. But it's a duality theorem. So MGC mod gamma is equivalent to M for the Langlands dual group modulo the annihilator of gamma. No. So you'll get now you'll get something that exchanges type B and C, for instance. So here, if I have a commutative group stack, then this sort of shifted cardioidal or one cardioidal is the commutative group stack of homomorphisms of A into the classifying stack of GM. So it generalizes the dual abelian variety. If I took an abelian variety and plugged it into this, I would get multiplicative line bundles on that abelian variety, so I would get the dual abelian variety. As a corollary, if I do take G to be ADE type, and I take gamma to be maximal isotropic, then I wind up with a self-dual moduli stack. And I would like to be able to find, say, an actual derivation from physics that tells me that those self-dual moduli stacks are the ones that I get from the theories of class S.
Right, and your self-dual moduli stack, I'm just confused about the state of gamma. So is that, saying that that was isomorphic to group stacks, and then on the left you have a quotient of mg of c by gamma.
Yep.
And so it means that your stack is actually the quotient of MGC by gamma, or what?
Yes. So, suppose that you put in G is SLN, and let's take gamma.
Should I do a one?
Take gamma to be nothing, so that the annihilator of gamma is everything. Then what does this say? It says M SLN C away from this discriminant locus, that the dual of that is given by M SLN C mod H1 of the curve with coefficients in Z mod N, again, away from the discriminant locus. So this should look a lot like Hazlitt Thaddeus's result. So they don't say it like this, but what's going on? Well, I already said that it only actually depends, the geometry of the connected components only depends on the degree mod N. So by taking this space instead of the Higgs bullet, I'm looking only at the degree mod N. And if I want to interpret this side, I could interpret this side as the moduli space away from the discriminant locus, can interpret it as the moduli space of PGLN Higgs bundles, but it's equipped, as in the moduli space is equipped with some Z mod N gerb, exactly the gerb of liftings of the universal projective Higgs bundle to the universal Higgs vector bundle. So for type A in this choice of gamma, you see essentially the result of Hazlitt and Thaddeus. And again, just for a self-dual space here, I could have taken gamma to be maximal isotropic, and then I would wound up with one of the self-dual examples. Just give one more example. And then,
that's 8 o'clock, but
it's probably a good time to stop off with this. So, let's take G to be, well, we're going to do a type B and C exchange. So take M SO2N plus 1 away from discriminant locus. And the theorem says that this is going to be the dual of the SP2N version of the space. So let's just interpret both sides. Let's break down what this is saying. So on this side, I have spin C, 2n plus 1 Higgs bundles. Let's call them E phi. This phi has to have trace equal to 0, where by trace I mean the map that's induced by the determinant map, together with an isomorphism of the push forward of E with either the trivial bundle or OC of X. So I only have two connected components in this particular example. Over here, the thing that I'm dualizing, we can interpret as the moduli space of projective symplectic Higgs bundles. So I'm working with the moduli space again, and then I'm going to say it's got some extra Sackey structure. What is that? It's equipped with, again, a gerb of liftings, which is now a Z mod 2 gerb from the gerb that measures the obstruction to lifting the universal projective symplectic Higgs bundle to the universal general symplectic Higgs bundle, possibly with fixed time. I might take that as the end.
Can you say anything about singular Hitchin fibers?
No, I can't. I'd like to be able to, but I can't. This is all happening. Maximally nice place.
For the proof of this theorem, do somehow, is it just a quarter of the like a bunch of, or is it some?
Yeah, no, to actually prove this, you basically say, all right, I'm going to slice this space out. I obtain this space by slicing this out of some space that I know how to dualize, and then taking some quotient like this. And then, yeah, you need to figure out. You need to figure out exactly what the right moduli spaces to look at are, but once you have that, then you can apply it to Nagy-Pantov and play around a little bit, and then ultimately get this result.
Are you saying that this inclusion of Higgs G tilde into the actual Higgs bundle moduli space somehow like respects the SYZ vibration in
this
way, and that's how you're able to?
Yes. I mean, and you can see, you know, what's the base that this one is defined over? It's the Hitchin base for this guy, except I cut out the zero locus for sort of the trace or the generalization of the trace of the Higgs field.
And all the species are they all poles symplectic?
Yeah, or at least the smooth locus is definitely going to be, yeah. I mean, in the end, whereas by restricting away from the discriminant locus, you've got the action of a free group on a discrete free group, finite group, on your moduli space. Yes. Or, everything that I do, everything that I work with is sort of in the Higgs bundle complex structure. But yes, if you sort of rotate, then you'll get.
But can I actually deform this one? Are they supposed to be Pfeffer Keeler?
They should be, yeah, they should be Pfeffer Keeler. I mean, if you ask what's actually happening, you're getting something which is, again, just derived from your usual moduli space of Higgs bundles, right?
Is the complex structure one of the global systems? Somehow, is there, can we play the same game there? Or?
So I think so. The action of H1 is like hypomorphic. So I want to say yes. I haven't written it down, but I've got the action of I've got a hypomorphic action on this hyperkeeler space. So
you have a lot of functions. Yes, but okay. Here the whole thing is about some kind of finite group set.
Yeah, the finite set, you can just, I think you can really write down the list of functions which are defined under in the space function of gamma. Say, you know, like holonomies along this cycle valued in and not PSL, and holonomy along this cycle valued in SL.
Yes, but somehow you want a definition so that somehow it will be kind of manifest, that thing will kind of manifest a deformation of
this. Yeah.
Yeah. In general, there's not a there's not like a definition that I've written down of this as like a the solution to some explicit moduli problem. That's the question.
You'd expect from your early discussion that you could achieve this by thinking about a 3D TFT with one bounding condition on one side, one bounding condition on the other side. Do you know how to do that?
Not yet.
But I mean, this should come from composing an F, which comes from a 60 theory, not a billion one, and an F, if tilde comes from a billion 60 theory.
Okay.
Yeah, the 3D theory should be some discrete gauge theory for covalent surface values in the center or something. Some easy boundary condition and some complicated boundary condition.
Okay.
And a billion and 60 theory is a 3, so you should be able to understand it.
Refused to tell us actually what the in the first half of the talk you sort of told us some nice story about boundary conditions for TFTs.
Yeah.
You refused to tell us what those TFTs were.
I did.
Are you willing to tell us them to us now?
Because
you made sort of vague comments about like, well, you have this 5D TFT, which I presume is something completely explicit, and then like I could pick some boundary conditions. It wasn't clear to me how many of those were topological, but the topological ones should be something I could understand.
Yeah. Off the top of my head, I'm not going to recall exactly how to write down that TFT. I can tell you, for instance, how to construct the like the space of states. if you'd like to see that, but I don't remember the actual definition of everything.
How would you present the 7015?
Well, I don't even know the name of it, so I don't want to get a figure out
before I figure out. But it says it was only giving it as a 6 category, so it's a little bit. I got it.
Yeah.
No, but even the 5D theory, it'd be nice to, like.
Right. Yeah, just mathematical, how to formalize hyperform. This sort of description sounds to you.
Finite group gauge theories are completely fine in any dimension. I don't think you and I have any trouble with this.
No, so the definition in 7D would be that there's 3 form Samuel's theory valid in the center.
It's in like a higher version of Dyckhoff-Witten theory.
Absolutely.
It's a close cycle.
The class in the what is internal classifying space.
Right, no, that type of thing I think is systematic to write to.
So that's in here.
And then the in Richard's story, he wrote down like some 5D theories starting from the 70 to finite group theory. And then he like had some interesting supersymmetric theory about that came from 6 theory X. And then you had some other kind of boundary condition that you said was depending on like some, you know, maximal isotropic and some homology theory. Is that also something kind of, is that other one at least like explicit and finite group being topological, or is it subtle?
I think so. I mean, what happens when you ask this microphone? Case theory, this big case theory on the surface.
Then I just can look for topological boundaries.
Right. I think it would be nice to just do it and state it all the way to 2D. Also because the 3D topological theories are quite simple to think about. There should be some 2D theory based on the H2 of the surface. Final. Is it just these creatures are not, is it a graphic theory? For the group H2 of the surface into the center.
I think probably for some like drive group. Probably want all of the cohomology of the thing of a magnifying.
Okay.
Do you know the like physical origin of this 7D theory? Is there some string theory reason it pops out?
Exactly. So usually you define the 6D theory starting from string theory. But if you go look at what you get in string theory, it's always some absolute version that combines the 60 non-abelian 60 theory with some abelian stuff that makes it absolute. If you define it to holography, I think you can get relative versions easily. But in string theory, you usually get the absolute stuff. There is always some abelian thing, but for example, if you take a stack of M5 brains, you always get the abelian, you get the GLN version, you don't get the SLN. That's the relative only emerges when you try to throw away the abelian stuff.